Podcast.
What are we talking about today?
You don't know? You haven't heard?
I might already be starting my bit.
Oh no, you are always recording.
Intro music starts now.
Good morning, everyone.
And welcome to TechPoint Charlie.
Episode 12. So today we have Anne. And oddly enough, Anne comes from a company called CareShip. I think some of the people who are already familiar with our podcast heard the name CareShip in our previous episode.
That's right, because I started to work there a couple of months ago, already 4 months ago. So we've been working together for 4 months already. And actually the really recently after I started working at CareShip, and I was exposed to this function that you're doing, which is UX researcher. I actually have been waiting to work with someone in this role because I think it's an amazing thing to have in a company. And it's something I feel I was missing in lots of companies. And that's where we're so excited to have you here today to actually talk to us about that and what it means, what it is, you know, how it looks like. And so maybe just before we dive in, because I feel like I already started diving in, sorry, you can tell us a little bit about yourself so people who are listening can know who you are, you know, where you're from, your background.
Yeah, so I'm Anne, and I have the honor to work with Yael at CareShip, building product together, and I have the role of the user researcher. And yeah, what does that even mean? It's not such an easy thing. My colleagues actually sometimes call me tech anthropologist, or the developers actually sometimes say I'm a beautifully complex human being researcher because they themselves started to reject the word user. And I really like that. I think that's also my official Slack title, beautifully complex human being researcher. It's not very catchy. But yeah, reality is complex, and figuring that out for the product teams, that's my job.
Let's start maybe with what model is UX researcher then.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know, feels very buzzwordy currently for me, mm-hmm. the word UX. UX can be basically a person who's doing mock-ups. Sounds like something that is basically UX design became everything currently in the industry. So what is UX researcher in specifically?
Okay, yeah, so it's true there's a bit of an overlap in the skill set of a UX researcher and a designer, and there are many, many designers who are conducting research, which is a good thing, but also there's a lot out there which is actually something that is more research-flavored design than actual research, because it's quite a complex role that you can't just do on the side. Especially if you want to mature the approach in your organization, you have to build processes. So at the core of the role of a UX researcher is basically the middle of the process. So it goes from the core, extending on both sides. This is not a visual thing. It's a podcast. I'm realizing that now. I'm a very visual thinker. I always want to sketch things. But we will link all materials also so that you can have a look at them if you're not just the auditive type. So at the core of the role is actually really planning and conducting the research. And there are two types of research. One is explorative research, and the other one is usability testing. One is to spot problems and to understand them better. The other one is to test your solutions. What I just introduced was the core of the role, mm-hmm. but you will also see me at my desk, which means in fact that I'm not talking to a user in that moment, because the role is much bigger and also extends before the research is being planned and conducted. So basically you have to start really with the management and the strategy of a company. This is where research has to be kicked off, basically. Which problems are we trying to solve with our product and obviously the relevant problems to the people out there. Are there unmet needs, which is product opportunities for us? All these things, so prioritization of research questions is a huge part as well. And then you get the answers, but what then? Yeah, so you have a lot of data. How do you continue? I guess everybody who has ever conducted something, especially when it's not a testing, but a more explorative interview approach, and you sit there with a lot of data. And then the job, of course, continues to make this actionable. So you dive right into the analysis, and then really you need to be with the teams and guide them through and ensure as a user researcher that is a there's a coherent action and follow through based on the results of the testings that you've conducted. And as you know, there's so many iterations in a product, and basically at every point there needs to be another check-in. Are we meeting the user's needs to the best we can? So I always have multiple projects in various stages. That's why I'm working basically with everyone in the company at the same time. That leads me to like another point that is like probably the most important for my role. It's like be humble. As a user experience researcher, don't fall into the expert trap. Mm-hmm. Be humble. You are not the expert. My role is it to have, like, to push everybody in the company to have their own experiences with the people we are building product for, and to get their own insights. And my job is well done if you, Yael, as my colleague, know where we are at.
Sure.
But we are going to speak about that later, and we're talking about how to mature the approach in your company, what you can do to really basically, sometimes I feel like it's almost democratizing data, giving everybody access. And that is great, especially if you're working with OKRs and you want everybody in the company, no matter what their role is, to contribute to the success of the company.
So it's basically becoming a reflection of the customers or the people using the products in the organization a little bit, in a sense, because you said that you don't want to fall into the expert trap. So you basically talk to people, you collect data, and then you surface it to the product manager or the product owner, whatever it's called, marketing people and whatever, and then decisions could be made that are more informed. Is this the basic idea? Or
Yes and no.
Okay.
Very good that you're laying out how you perceive it, because I want to jump in there and be like, no, I'm not handing you anything. Mm-hmm. Like the times where you are handed a PDF research report are definitely over once and for all, at least in the startup scene where you want to go lean. So for me, it's really important that you, for example, also Russ, would be right in the research project with me. So we would already kick it off together. So you really have to think about what do you want to learn to deliver the best product possible. Mm-hmm. What is like the unknown? What is our risk we have to eliminate? And then I am just there basically to help you and your team figure out how to reduce the risk of what you're building, how to figure out how people would behave, which is very hard to do. And then we're going to go out there together or invite these people to our office. And that is already, like, to me, I feel like the most important part, that actually all my team members are there and have this firsthand experience, that they see who are these people, what is important to them, how do they use your product, what are they struggling with, and also especially what else is going on in their life that they are struggling with, and to realize that your product is also not at the center of their universe, but just, they are basically, I'm a huge fan of the Jobs to be Done framework. People just hire your product basically to get a certain job done. And with user research, we're going to figure out exactly what that is. And then, of course, we are also going to do a documentation. We are going to talk about that later also, how to store your data and make use of it later. But to get started, it's really the most important thing that everybody who's actively working on this part of a product is there in the research and has their own takeaways, and that you get together and do like a brain dump after research together in the team. Everybody shares their perspective, what they think they have learned. And this is really what makes it actionable, what the people take away from it themselves.
Mm-hmm. So what's our topic of the day, Anne?
Our topic of the day is how to mature your user-centered approach in your product organization. Because I feel user-centered has become such a buzzword. I think it's already peaked. I've seen it basically as the first word of every second person on LinkedIn in their bio. But when you actually talk with these people, it turns out that the definition and how that is lived in their organization is completely different. And there's actually a model, it's called the UX maturity model, that helps you to assess the maturity degree of the UX approach in your company, which basically just means how much of the user is actually in your user-centered approach. And yeah, user research is what helps you mature this approach, because of course, if you want to place the human being at the center of your product development approach, that means you have to interact with the people that are actually using your product. You have to talk to them. You have to test your solutions with them. And yeah, this will be our topic of the day.
It sounds awesome. And just kind of to understand for myself, maybe. So the motivation basically is for the listener and for myself as a person learning here would be to understand what are techniques that I can do to measure how centered my customer product is, or user product, or I don't like the word user as well. Mm-hmm. But so we can basically, after this episode, maybe learn how to assess how centered we are or focused on our customers, mm-hmm. or basically people who are using our stuff, and maybe adjust from that. Is this part of the motivation?
Exactly, exactly. You can basically, after hearing this episode, map out for yourself where your organization stands as in maturity of a UX approach, and you will also know exactly where you can go and what you need to do for that. Who you need on board.
Oh, that's great. Who you need on board. That sounds great for me. Okay, so let's dive deep into it then.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this too. I mean, I feel it's also very actionable. A lot of people are probably wondering if they are really like user-centered, as you said. Does our company actually live it or just say that we live it? And I think sometimes it's hard to distinguish whether it's true or not, because people have good intentions. And if you're already exposed to this topic and you say you want to be user-centered, maybe you feel you already are. So I really want to hear all about this framework. Right, then let's dive in maybe to the maturity method.
Yeah, so it's a 5 to 8 stage model depending on the source you look at. I would recommend the Nielsen-Norman group, who have basically shaped what is UX today for the last centuries, I think. We will link the material. And the idea with this model is simply that organizations usually go through the same sequence of phases regarding their mindset towards user-centeredness. And it starts basically at stage one with a hostile relationship with user-centeredness, which is probably something that like the younger generation like me has maybe not even experienced. It's more of an old school software development where it's mostly developers and they are sitting in this room closing the door saying, we're delivering features, we don't care who uses them.
They could use terminal as far as I care.
You're right, and now the mindset is more like, we should not train people to use product, it should be seamless, easy, self-understood, something that people don't even need to make any effort around in order to get what they need from it. And for that exactly, we need like a holistic point of view of the entire, like how we build it, how does operation work with it, which is an excellent point, because our product is not just what an app does, right? It's everything around it.
Yeah. It's a multi-channel experience for sure. And yeah, so in this model, you start with a hostile stage, where I hope none of the organizations of our listeners are in. Mm-hmm. If not, we'll do something about it today. And it goes basically all the way to the whole organization is relying on insights from user research, which does not mean the whole organization is relying on the user researcher. If that is the case, something is very, very wrong with the user researcher, I guess. No, it means the whole organization has understood the value that you can get from actually exploring the life of the people that you are designing for. Mm-hmm. All the way to management, and also that of course then means that strategic decisions are being made as educated decisions, mm-hmm. with a lot of research in advance, which is not always easy, especially if you have to react fast in like a startup environment. So of course it can happen also that you have a team where everybody is super aligned that they want to work in this user-centered way. But in practice, then, you sometimes deviate. So it's not like, oh, we get a badge now. My organization has reached the highest level. We're there. But it's a struggle you face every day to make room, to get buy-in from everybody to work in this way.
Right, because it's much easier not to talk to users all the time. It's, I mean, much easier in the sense of like less distracting, let's call it like this, because the activities of discovery and actually incorporating those insights are sometimes hard to do, is what I mean.
Yeah. So maybe as an example, in the middle of this model, in the stages where is the stage where the organization has realized design matters. We need to have good UI, and there's more than UI. It's called UX. Hey, how do people interact with our product? But then in this stage, it's more like the designers become the new gods, basically, and go with the gut feeling and with best practices of how good interaction design works. And there, if you rely too much just like on your past experience and on guidelines and don't do a constant check-in with your audience, you will be like outdated and fail as well. Let's maybe align on like three dimensions of a model we can consider, which is like the scope of the research that is conducted, which can be zero in stage one, the purpose of the research, what are you trying to figure out, and the staffing, who's involved.
Oh, if there is anyone involved, you mean in general, or like
no, I mean the staffing can also be very different. Like you said before, it can be the researcher conducting it, can be just design, can be everyone.
Yeah, so maybe other examples that I've encountered also in other companies, not only startups actually, sometimes you can hear people, actually in companies where you have the maybe approach of researching or at least, I guess, validating solutions, so usability testing, you hear things like, yeah, but we've decided to make this feature is one thing, but you do usability testing. And I guess maybe it's not exactly a question, but an example of where, I mean, I wonder where it falls into the description of this method, right? Of this framework, when you say, okay, we did a lot of usability testing because we care to see how the solution is executed. But if we find something that's contradicting to actually the making of that feature, how do we compute this? So a lot of people feel uncomfortable and maybe disregard this a little bit. So where does it fall in this, like when you look at this from the outside? Because this is very common, right?
Yeah, I guess this is probably the most common approach these days. Having a lot of usability testing, validating solutions. It's in the model, it's clearly in the middle, and it's sort of affecting the question, what is the purpose of your research? Mm-hmm. And you already said it, it's validating a solution. If you want to go more mature, you start earlier in the process. In the end, it's nothing but a question of like, how does your product development process look like and who's involved? So here you are spending most of your time in the solution space. It's not bad, because I feel like from these these questions, it's not like you start in the beginning, you start in the middle with your process, you start getting better there. It's great that you're doing this solution validation. It's not bad. It's really good. You get a lot of experience there. And when you have that figured out and you feel comfortable, then you can start expanding it from there, and you can start asking questions like, okay, why are we building this feature? Who made this decision? Who was in the room? Should I be in this room too? And based on which data was this decision made? Should I be in the room where is being decided, like where we allocate resources to figure out what are the unmet needs of our users? And like, how does this whole process happen? So it's a lot about understanding your organization, the roles, and taking an active part in it. Which I think also everybody can do. Like, no matter what your role is, if you're just being handed a task, could be even like a Jira ticket where there's not enough context of like, how is this valuable to the user? That is really the question. Then ask questions. And if nobody can answer them, then you have already assessed the maturity of the UX approach in your company. And then, yeah, you can be the person to continue asking these questions, and people will listen. And at some point, you will have different answers than, yeah, because the business needs it, because management said so. Like, keep digging.
So maybe you can give us an example of how it looks like in a more mature organization, because probably you've seen it or heard from the community of UX researchers also, like, how does it look like? Who's in the room? You know, what things can you hear that are happening?
Yeah. So it's a lot about the team setup from the beginning on. I have to say, at CareShip, we were so lucky. It's actually a great example because our head of product really built the product team from the beginning on in a way that it goes hand in hand with this approach. So first she hired a BI person to deal with quantitative data. And then the second hire was already me, like qualitative researcher. When the quantitative data tells you really good, like, what are people doing? And when I came in, start figuring out why are people behaving in this way? And then you start hiring the product managers and designers, and they start to develop solutions based on research that has already been done. So research basically has to be a bit in advance, so way more long-term, strategic. I always have at least one project that is outside of the current OKR cycle, of the current goals, just to prep the next upcoming quarters. And this is how you can see basically that your organization is a bit more mature and more long-term thinking than just validating solution approach after solution approach. So you basically have this dual track agile model where solution is being built, but at the same time it's being researched. What are the unmet needs and how can we solve them in the future? And what makes it then super mature is if this is not a fake dual track agile, this is actually a waterfall, but if the same people that are building the solution are also dedicating time and resources to already do the research to plan the next things that they are going to work on.
Yeah. That's, I mean, as you were saying, I mean, we're both sitting here and nodding because we're like, yeah, it sounds amazing. And I think it's also really hard to distinguish maybe from the outside what is really like waterfallish, kind of like we're doing research, but in order to kind of validate some sort of a product plan that maybe, you know, we wrote down somewhere and we have a yearly whatever feature set and we're kind of trying to make it go together. Versus actually researching something in a broader context and being really open to being surprised or learning about more about what life around this product looks like and which things we're not yet doing. And I, this is just a, I mean, personally, I feel very lucky to be a part of this type of team because it's really open and you can see that the OKRs are really changing between quarters where we're trying to nail down the next problems and not just the next features. So I guess this is a question actually. So every time we do usability testing and also explorative research, I guess well, maybe I need to phrase it a bit differently. Sorry, I'm kind of getting lost here. But actually keeping your mind open means we're always doing some explorative research, right? Or no?
Yes. Yes, it yes. does mean that. And it means it's going to be messy, basically. Mm-hmm. If you are open to explore what is on the right and on the left of your super fast product track, then you're going to end up with a lot of messy data that you can't always make sense of yet. Mm-hmm. So it's really important that you start storing this data in a way that once you have accumulated a certain amount of it, mm-hmm. you can analyze it for patterns. And this is how you actually discover new problems and mm-hmm. unmet needs. So there's basically no usability test that I conduct where we don't have at least a short interview session before, where it's really about figuring out where is this person in their life and how does our product even come into play, what kind of role does it play. Because if you just assume that it's a relevant thing for this person, you put it in front of them, you're like, is it usable? You're always just going to get an assessment of how usable is the product and not be able to predict, will they use it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess there's also like some sort of a bias anyhow when you sit in front of a person and they are there for a reason and they also want to contribute and make you happy to some extent. So if your mind is not completely open, they can feel that and maybe, you know, answer the specific question instead of like telling you a bit more, which is where the relearning is really happening.
True. Yeah, it's this is a whole other podcast series about how to actually do the user research and methodologies. But I feel like oftentimes the most important question is actually the last one. Is there anything that is important to you that we haven't talked about today? Mm-hmm. So everything that is absolutely not on your radar. And I always let the recording of a testing session or the interview running until the person has actually left the room, because sometimes the door's already open and they turn around and they say the one thing that really matters. Wow. And that is direction.
I'm wondering, question to the careship people here. Do you have roadmaps? I'm wondering if you have a roadmap or is it more based on big level problem spaces that you work towards?
Definitely the second one. Definitely the problem spaces. I think one of the things that I'm most proud of, both of us probably, is that the fact that we are focusing on problems and not on features. It's actually one of our core principles in the product team. We have like on the wall saying we deliver value, not features. And I guess this also represents our minds being open to actually what should we work on next in terms of what to solve and not how necessarily solve it. Okay. Of course, we have to go to solutions later, but definitely problem solving. I wanted to ask you, Anne, about, you said it would be messy, right? And I think that's where people, even the best intentioned people, feel that it's hard, right? Because you do a couple of interviews, then whatever system you use, you have those insights, and then you continue to do it over time, if you're lucky and you know you do it in a company. And then it's hard to make sense of, which maybe we can talk about tools we're using or some a recommendation that you have, or we can also link that. But also, you talked about an organization being more or less mature, and I wonder, what's your experience with, team leads or management feeling uncomfortable, you know, with something not being completely clear, because it takes time to get through these insights. So maybe you've conducted something for 3 or 6 months and something is not super clear, or something is but doesn't completely fit what we're doing right now. How does it look like when you work in an environment that is a bit more mature?
Good question. Yeah, this brings us basically to the point, who do you need on board to mature the UX approach in your organization? And I feel like if you want to do it bottom up, it's going to be hard. It's not impossible. You have to really start small, pick a tiny project, and spread what value you created with that project. It's really a lot about evangelizing. But for me, this works best if you also have somebody helping you from the opposite direction, top down, really best somebody, you have an ally in management who really gets it, who has the same vision of how they want to build product than your team does, and they support you. Because on one hand, it's a cultural thing, which you can do really well bottom up with evangelizing and winning over person by person with mm-hmm. the value that you create. But on the other hand, it's also a thing of, financial resources. Where are they allocated? And spending more time in the problem space, of course, if it's the same people that are building the solution, takes out a bit of speed, velocity of building the solution, mm-hmm. As in quantity of features that are delivered, not as in quality of solutions that solve actually relevant problems. But this is something that you can preach over and over again for somebody who has not experienced that mm-hmm. to be true. It's like hard. So if you can somehow find an ally that is actively shaping the strategy and the way the company is run, that's the best thing that can happen to you.
Because even spending time is money, basically. If you exactly. spend time in the problem space and not the solution space, it means that person, whatever percentage that is, they're not spending on something else. So you have to, I guess you have to have a buy-in and align it, right? If you want to really make it happen, make sure people spend time on this engineering, for example, marketing. I mean, everyone has their activities and their very measurable goals, and these things can feel not tangible in the beginning of like, how does this contribute, you know?
Exactly. I sometimes feel like I'm like fighting this prejudice of, but I'm doing the real work here, you know? You're taking me away from like creating the actual value because I'm like building something, I'm coding, can you see that? But I think it's really, really important to step up and participate also in the process where it's being defined what is being built. Mm-hmm. And if you start then building a solution with a like really in-depth understanding of the value that this creates for the people that are going to use it, I feel like you have way more motivation, and you can also be more creative in your own work. And this is what I deeply, deeply believe in, that everybody in the product team and in the engineering team and like in the whole company has their very own unique skill set and perspective and way of contributing. And they can come up with solutions that a product manager or me as a user researcher could never come up with. So only if they also understand the actual problem we are trying to solve, they can come up with new ways, really innovative ways, how we can create value there. So basically, with every person that does not understand or has had a first-hand experience of like the problem that your company is trying to solve, you lose innovation power. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to put a number on that. Like, how much is it worth? True. To have this understanding and this mindset in a company.
Yeah, true. But I mean, I feel this is a shift that is happening in the recent years of like to solve the right problems and not just to do things right, you know?
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, let's just do things right. I mean, I know it, right? It's like, it's so easy, isn't it?
Yeah.
But of course, that's also not entirely wrong, because there's also a thing that I like to call like data-driven intuition, where of course the human brain is amazing, and like the tool we're going to talk about later that I'm using, where I'm basically trying to replicate the human brain and making connections with data, it's never going to be as good as what humans can do. So of course it's valid to use your gut feeling and your intuition and your problem-solving skills, your logic, based on the data that you collected, based on the experiences that you've had, you can then use your intuition for the solution.
Yeah, so it's important to say, because I think sometimes people feel like going in a data-informed way of working, it takes away the creativity.
Hmm.
And a lot of people are saying, well, the iPhone wouldn't have been invented if we would have done this and we just let data run everything. But I think that the reality is, if you're not driven by data in a sense where like data tells you exactly what you do, and but you're informed and you make an informed decision, it also gives you a space to basically just take a data informed bet. Yeah. Or like you just can say, even though the data shows me this, it's a reflection of what I see, I can still have a hunch and go in a different direction, but I make sure that I know what's what I have on the other side.
It's amazing because you say data a lot, and what I feel I want to add into this, that data basically means information. So when people say data, we usually think of numbers, right? Quantitative data, like how many people clicked on this or that, and that shows us what they do in reality in terms of behaviors that we can measure by clicks or tracking of some sort. But data is also information that is qualitative, which is what we're talking about right now. That can be accumulated to like how many people have said one thing is a combination of both, right? Of numbers, but also quotes. Quotes is something that I guess if you read a lot about, like from other people's experiences, or if you participate in those researches activities, then that can become that hunch, right? Because you have all those quotes in your head of people that you've met. It's like maybe being with a friend for a long, long time and you've seen what they do. You kind of try to, you know, you're trying to get a gift for them. And you say, they've said this a lot of times and they've spoken about this a lot of times. So I kind of know, maybe I can assume how they would feel if I buy them this gift, if I make this product from them, if I offer them this service. So that I think this is kind of what we're going towards, that you can create that hunch by getting to know them really well, is what we're trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, you're asking the question, what is creativity? How do we generate ideas? And personally, I don't feel like we are generating them out of nowhere or pulling them out of the center of the universe. But it's based on past experience. And if that experience is with the actual people and you have a lot of empathy created there, and it's great. But it also takes us to a risk of user research because, it's a bit of a debate between people saying, just do it. It's always great. And people saying, no user research is better than bad user research. Mm-hmm. Because what if you bring the wrong people in that are not even your target audience and your whole team bases their creative sources on their needs and on their profiles. Right. So it really starts with research operations, which is its own role, basically. We all do it on the side as if it was nothing, but it's actually its own role. It has a huge community internationally, which we're also going to link on Slack, which is only about like how do we set up research and research processes so that we create value with it. And how can it fit your organization so that there's not a massive overhead, but also that you can reach exactly the goals that you have. And yeah, like finding the right participants is a huge thing. The insights you're going to get are only going to be as reliable as the profile of the participants is matching your audience. So depending on the sector you're working in, this is already really, really hard. Imagine you're working on medical software for surgeons, brain surgeons. Yeah. How many user tests can you conduct with professional brain surgeons?
So we've talked about this maturity framework quite a bit. And it's a lot of details, super interesting, but maybe we can just try to summarize it a little bit so it's a bit of a more bite size and people can wrap their heads around this.
All right. Yeah. So if you want to assess the maturity of the UX approach in your company, there are several dimensions you can look at. The scope of user research, is it being conducted at all? And if yes, to what extent? The purpose is very important. We've talked about that a lot. Are you more in the solution space, doing a lot of usability testing to just figure out, is it a good solution? Is it usable? Or are you also extending already to the problem space, trying to figure out, does it solve a relevant problem? Which other problems are out there we might be solving in the future? And then also the staffing, we've talked about that a lot too. Who's involved? Is it one person conducting the research? Is it just in the design team, the whole product team? Is engineering involved? And are also the other various departments in the company part of it? And then the last thing is probably like the degree of educated decisions, strategy decisions in your company. How does management leverage on user research insights, and do they also suggest projects of research before they make an important decision to really understand the problem better?
Excellent.
Yeah. I learned a whole lot. I'm wondering, because we kind of touched it when we weren't recording, engineers being engaged into this. So I've never had engineers engage in user research.
Really?
Yes. Well, we were building prototypes like clickers for user research, but we're not actually part of the user research. And knowing engineers, I'm wondering if it's, if you've had that, the two of you, if you're doing that, and are they happy about it?
Well, I can quickly say that people who have worked with me in the past know me as the person who always gets an engineer into the room for interviews. Initially was at some under excuse of like, oh, I need someone to help with note taking. And then when they've had the great, I mean, I'm kind of like giving it away now. No, but seriously, I mean, it's super important. And even though it's sometimes hard to explain why to people because of this evangelism, it's really hard, right? If you know something's important, but it, to make it clear to other people so they actually want would volunteer and join, then, usually I was doing it like in some initial small steps. And then when they realized, okay, this is amazing. And then when we talked about, you know, things we want to make, and I was like, what do you think, you were there in the room to kind of like experience it, they started talking to each other and bringing people in. And it's also super practical because sometimes you do need someone to just participate in the actual activity of whatever, note-taking and, you know, observing and making sure you're not the only one there. So definitely yes. But I've also had the experience of people saying, I would never join, and I don't understand why, and it's definitely not my job, like, leave me be, and, you know, don't talk to me, I want to just write code. So I've seen them both, actually. What about you?
First of all, I really love your note-taking trick. Excuse. Ms. Chivas.
Can you help me?
Can I ever trust you again? yeah, I've definitely also seen both, but way more people who show a genuine interest, at least in user research. I think I was lucky enough to have from the mindset a lot of people who in general agree on how they want to build product and that it is important. Then you then actually approach them and ask them if they have the time to join. It often looks a bit different. Mm. But also that is a lot... at least I have a feeling a lot of like protection mechanisms, because a lot of people are also a bit shy about going out of the office building, visiting people at home for field studies and actually engaging with them. And especially here in Berlin, we have also a wonderful international community in the product scene, but our customers are German. So language is also another barrier where I also like have complete understanding for everybody who's a bit shy about their skills. But I always say, as long as you can say guten Tag und danke schön, you can come with me anytime and just smile and nod a bit, and you will take away so much, especially from methods like field studies, where you can just really take in the whole environment where people are using your product, and where emotions, I think, are super universal. And then what I offer as well is to, I basically, similar to the note-taking, kind of like bribe our teams with breakfast. So we're hosting usability breakfasts on a regular basis, where in the morning at best before stand-up, you can just join, grab a croissant and have a look at user testing on recording, video, Yeah, it's like a cinema. And then we switched to digital post-its even, so we're not killing trees. And everybody can just participate in virtual note-taking. And then afterwards, we see if we find patterns in our observations. And I never stop highlighting how valuable the perspective of engineers, both back-end and front-end, is. Sure. Because the kind of observations that they have when they look at these tests is like completely different. I'm always impressed, and it's like, wow, I would have never noticed this person interacting with a date picker that confuses them. I didn't even see that because I have no idea how to implement a date picker. and also like what data is being loaded from the back end, especially we have a lot of like showing the people that the seniors can be matched with, and the way this randomizer of how the profiles are chosen works, and just like this whole knowledge about what our product does, especially for the usability testing part, is like so powerful. So I think once the engineers joined and they've seen how much appreciated the input is, and also how valuable it is for them when they continue working on this part of the product,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's a great experience for everybody involved.
I think it's usually the initial experience that is hard for people, right? Because they say either it's a language thing or they're scared, like, how would I feel going to someone's home or meeting someone I don't know, and they're, you know, cozy in their environment and they're good at their job and that's why they're there. And maybe they feel, I don't know, should they have a specific skill or something? So I guess this is us like nodding to one to another and saying, okay, just try, just join. I mean, you don't have to be leading the interview. There's a person there with you. Just come listen, see the people, listen to them, see where they live, right?
So I'm going to be devil's advocate right now.
Oh,
so
no, please.
You're going to basically, you're telling the engineering manager currently that one of the development power is just being moved away from development to something else. What's the motivation? What's the gain in this? Why should engineering teams and engineering managers should really care about giving away one of their producers, individual contributors, as we call it in the industry, to something else, to do something that is not contributing in code?
Mm. So if I'm talking with a manager directly, I'd be quite straightforward, sit them down and say, let's have a look at the calendar of your engineers. Let's have a look how much time they are spending with the product managers doing like planning, backlog grooming, trying to prioritize, really understand the tickets, the problem they are trying to solve there, just assuming that I'm working in a team where it's relevant to the people, like what problem is this feature solving? And then really let's sum up how much time this alignment is taking until somebody is empowered. Because right in product development, you don't just want to like hand over tasks. You want empowered contributors who solve the problem to their best knowledge. And how do you create this understanding? Like, of course, you can have a product manager be the middleman and sit them down and explain to them. But how much is getting lost with this middleman? Or woman.
Yeah. Yeah.
And from there, I would just suggest a small trial study and have them contribute in something, maybe not so much in the problem, more abstract problem identification like approach, but something more tangible. Let's do a simple usability test, have some engineers involved, and see what comes around. What kind of value do we create with that? And take the time to have some kind of retro on a sprint with user research, and also check in with each of the team members. How did it make them feel? What did they take away from it? And if they come to the conclusion that they don't need it, then I will consider that, honestly. It's not that you just have to do user research. If maybe you're not there yet. Maybe you're just not there yet. Maybe you chose the wrong method. Yeah. Or maybe you had the wrong candidates and they were all not really contributing. That can happen too. And you just have people where you just won't talk. They click through your prototype in 3 seconds and say like, yeah, whatever. But it's bad research too. That can happen. It's not a shame. I think it's just really important to have an open conversation about it. And if somebody has concerns, just raise them. That's the most important thing.
I mean, just to summarize, it's it's a mindset for managers as well, but it can start as an activity of 1 hour, right? Participate in something, or 30 minutes participate in an activity just to experience it. It doesn't have to be a whole week.
The shortest thing that I'm offering to join is actually 10-minute phone interviews.
Amazing.
For the people who are very, very early in the user journey and have just discovered our product. Very interesting target group. And you can just join 10 minutes and 5-minute debrief after. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very important to offer a variety of activities. And I understand that not everybody, also people like in a higher management position, maybe don't have the time to drive 1 hour to a customer's home and do a 2-hour field study there. Yeah. But there's something that everybody can participate in.
Yeah, I like that approach very much.
But I also have my numbers that I'm trying to keep up. So on the door to our product team, we have a dashboard, a physical dashboard with post-its. And this dashboard tells us three numbers. The first number is the number of people that we've interviewed or tested with. The second number is the days that have passed since the last contact with our target audience. And the last number is the percentage share of the team that has actively participated in research within the last 3 months. And it's very visible on the door. So you can't even enter your workspace to code without noticing how user-centered your team is working recently.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And just so also to really share my opinion, I think generally contextualizing the problem and having a developer or two or three even spend an hour a week to understand the people you're working for, like the problems you're trying to solve, will solve much more time and develop.
Yeah, which means they're thinking, they're taking ownership and they're empowered to actually bring this to the table, even make decisions, obviously, when there's trust and alignment.
Yeah.
And they're bringing possible solutions to a problem they understand and empathize with, which is exactly what you were saying. I mean, if you empathize with the problem and you know a lot about it and you know the users, the people behind that actually experience your product, then you're motivated and you can innovate about, like, what you can give them. And that's for really everyone. And I concur. I mean, I've had discussions with the development teams, with engineers, maybe you can call them product engineers now, that were really, they understood the problem so well that we ended up changing so much of the things that, you know, initially I've defined because I thought maybe this is the best solution. But after talking to them, we just discussed and realized there are a lot of other ways to solve it that are much, much better. And I mean, if you're an engineering manager talking to engineers, I'm a product person talking to other product people saying, involve your engineering teams because they are extremely smart in, I mean, in the whole life cycle, not just in actually writing code. And it's amazing to engage everyone from operations, from marketing, from engineering. And it always sounds like it's a long day of discussions and meetings, but first, it's not always that. And after you achieve alignments, those conversations are actually shorter. Or even if they're still long, they're much more productive. It's amazing.
It's weird because I read an article saying that OKRs is basically a tool for micromanagement. And it is if people are not showing up in the OKR mm-hmm. meetings. Of course, developers will complain, OKRs is a tool of micromanagement. I just like, there are those meetings and then we need to do stuff. Like,
you can use it this way, but
if you're not joining them and you're not sharing your information and you're not part of defining the problem space, then it could be that.
Or if you also suck.
Yeah, or if the methods suck. But like, if the entire concept of the OKR is built in a way where it's going middle out, right? Like you have all those things built from all those perspectives and it's like meet in the middle and then you kind of shape them. And it's kind of tried to look at the 360 view. But if you have like an entire department of people not showing up, then you're like, you're missing the perspective.
I think they should participate, obviously, but I was also part of other discussions saying that engineering and sometimes design, although design to me is not included, are service departments. And
that's bullshit.
Yeah, but that's a different perspective on this.
Push it more.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm on a Twitter war currently for like the last week.
Still?
Yes, a week now, because so someone at Shopify tweeted that their lovely, lovely leadership decided, and he said it in a positive way, by the way. So a developer at Shopify said, I am so happy to work with such strong and brave leadership that they now have a bot that goes and remove recurring meetings once in a while randomly, to remove overhead and dumb meetings that should just be avoided. And I was like replying, what? I find it to be extremely offensive. You're basically babyfying your employees and you're treating meetings as a terrible thing. And I would go apeshit if one of my meetings have just evaporated and I wouldn't even known about it. And also, meetings is work, and discussing and actually thinking about things is not a negative thing.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, well, maybe it's empowering people not to go into meetings that have no voice. I'm like, well, that's a different problem that you probably need to fix. Like, empowering your employees to say, maybe I shouldn't be in this meeting is one thing, but just randomly removing stuff. And then I retweeted it and said, I wonder if the CEO's meetings are also, and that's where the war started, because I retweeted his tweet and I was like, I wrote, I wonder if your CEO is also part of the new king of meetings. And then like people started commenting and it became
very good.
Kind of story, yeah.
I mean, it's not like meetings are a bad thing if you hate your meeting so much and you have a problem with your meeting culture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if you hate the food so much that you're being served every day, then maybe the cooking is bad and not food is a problem, like in general. Yeah. Like, I'm just not gonna eat anymore now. Just let me live. I'm not going to waste my time eating.
I'm basically going to remove meetings randomly for all the employees. That's brave leadership. Creating a bot that removes meetings. It's just so childish.
This should be in our next episode of Good Manager, Bad Manager.
I actually wanted to bring it up as a mini episode just to talk about it. It's like a big fuck you to Shopify.
By the way, we can't, because this is our podcast.
You
can say welcome to Checkpoint Charlie mini episode.
Yeah, and fuck you, Shopify. This Twitter war goes to a podcast now.
There's a Twitter war, but we have a podcast. We can all talk about it.
I have two current open Twitter wars. Oh, man.
Yesterday, we were like in a cafe, and he was like, I'm like, is this important? He's like, I'm just a part of
it. Someone is wrong on the internet and I need to tell them that. Yeah, let's go back to our episode though.
So I guess we're heading towards the end of the episode. Maybe we can summarize a little bit what we talked about.
Me?
Yes.
Oh, man. Okay, to summarize the episode, what I'm trying to basically hope that the listeners got from this is that there is a way for them to actually assess how engaged they are in their, what is user-centered for them at least, or what does it mean? And like basically there is a framework that they can actually just check themselves according to. Take a look at those five steps?
Yeah, it's actually 4 to 8 depending on the model. I think the one that we're going to share is 5, not too many.
Okay, so 5 steps, I guess. And and basically understand where they are, and if they really do want to improve in that, they can actually take a look at it, read it, listen to the episode, and then improve. And of course, as maybe this is my take, there is no prescribed solution for anything in life, so do understand your context and scope and see if it makes sense or not, in what ways. As I'm also against overhauls in general, I would say start small and then build upon that and see improvements. Yeah. That's my kind of wishy-washy summary of this great episode.
Love it.
Yay. So thanks everyone for listening.
Yeah, and thank you, Anne, for taking the time and coming over. I think it was such a learning experience and really like eye-opening on like how you can look at those things and the essential of what this is and how you can participate and utilize and how actually everyone needs to be a part of this so we can do things better together, really.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation, guys. I had a lot of fun.